filling his share. I listened to a lot of this, but didn't swallow all of it. These gang guys are generally full of crap and like to exaggerate their stories, especially when it comes to money and violence. But I liked Quinn. He was probably the best friend I've made yet in prison. We never celled together, but we were close. Do you know why he walked away? Victor Westlake asks. I think so. Quinn was selling pot and doing well. He was also smoking a lot of it. As you know, the quickest way out of a federal camp is to get caught with drugs or alcohol. Strictly prohibited. Quinn got word through a snitch that the COs knew about his business and they were about to bust him. He's extremely smart and savvy, and he never kept the drugs in his cell. Like most of the guys who sell on the black market, he hid his inventory in common areas. The heat was on, and he knew if he got caught, he'd be sent away to a tougher place. So he walked. I'm sure he didn't walk far. Probably had someone waiting close by. Do you know where he is now? I nod. Take my time. Say, he has a cousin. Don't know his name, but he owns a couple of strip clubs in Norfolk, Virginia, near the naval base. Find the cousin, and you'll find Quinn. Under what name? I don't know, but it's not Quinn Rucker. How do you know this? Sorry, but that's none of your business. At this point, Westlake nods at an agent by the door, and he disappears. The search is on. Let's talk about Judge Fawcett, Westlake says. Okay, I reply. I cannot count the number of times I have lived for this moment. I have rehearsed this in the darkness of my cell when I couldn't sleep. I have written it in narrative form, then destroyed it. I have said the words out loud while taking long, lonely walks around the edges of Frostburg. It's hard to believe this is finally happening. A big part of his gang's business was running cocaine from Miami to the major cities along the East Coast, primarily the Southern Leg, Atlanta, Charleston, Raleigh, Charlotte, Richmond, and so on. Interstate 95 was the favorite route because it is so heavily traveled, but the gang used every state highway and county road on the map. Most of it was mule running. They would pay a driver $5,000 to rent a car and haul a trunk load of coke to a distribution center in, pick a city. The mule would make the drop, then turn around and drive back to South Florida. According to Quinn, 90% of the coke snorted in Manhattan gets there in a car rented by a mule in Miami and driven north as if on legitimate business. Detection is virtually impossible. When mules are caught, it's because someone snitched. Anyway, Quinn had a nephew who was working his way up the ladder of the family business. The kid was mule running, and he got caught speeding on Interstate 81 just outside of Roanoke. He was in a rented Avis van and said he was delivering antique furniture to a store in Georgetown. There was indeed furniture in the van, but the real cargo was cocaine, with a street value of $5 million. The state trooper was suspicious and called for a backup. The nephew knew the rules and refused to allow a search of the van. The second trooper was a rookie, a real eager beaver, and he began poking around the cargo bay of the van. He had no warrant, no probable cause, and no permission to search. When he found the cocaine, he went ballistic and everything changed. I pause and take a sip of water. The agent with the laptop is pecking away, no doubt sending directives all over the East Coast. "What is the nephew's name?" Westlake asks. "I don't know. But I don't think his last name was Rucker. Within his family, there are several last names and a fair number of aliases. And so the nephew's case was assigned to Judge Fawcett?" Westlake asks, prompting me along, though no one seems to be in a hurry. They're hanging on every word and anxious to find Quinn Rucker, but they want the whole story. "Yes, and Quinn hired a big lawyer in Roanoke, one who assured him the search was blatantly unconstitutional. If the search was thrown out by Fawcett, then so was the evidence. No evidence, no trial, no conviction, nothing. Somewhere in the process, Quinn learned that Judge Fawcett might look more favorably upon the nephew's case if some cash could change hands. Serious cash. According to Quinn, the deal was brokered by their lawyer. And no, I do not know the name of the lawyer." "How much cash?" Westlake asks. $500,000. This is met with great skepticism, and I am not surprised. "I found it hard to believe, too. A federal judge taking a bribe. But then I was also shocked when an FBI agent was caught spying for the Russians. I guess under the right circumstances, a man will do just about anything." "Let's stay on subject here," Westlake says, irritated. "Sure. Quinn and the family paid the bribe. Fawcett took the bribe. The case crept along until one day when there was a hearing on the nephew's motion to exclude the evidence that was seized during a bad search. Much to everyone's surprise, the judge ruled against the nephew, in favor of the government, and ordered a trial. With no defense, the jury found the kid guilty. But the lawyer felt good about their chances on appeal. The case is still rattling on appeal. In the meantime, the nephew is serving an 18-year sentence in Alabama." "This is a nice story, Mr. Bannister," Westlake says. "But how do you know Quinn Rucker killed the judge?" "Because he told me he was going to do it, out of revenge, and to retrieve his money. He talked about it often. He knew exactly where the judge lived, worked, and liked to spend his weekends. He suspected the money was hidden somewhere in the cabin, and he firmly believed he wasn't the only one who'd been ripped off by Fawcett. And because he told me, Mr. Westlake, he will target me as soon as he's arrested. I might walk out of prison, but I'll always look over my shoulder. These people are very smart. Look at your own investigation. Nothing. Not a clue. They hold grudges, and they are very patient. Quinn waited almost 3 years to kill the judge. He'll wait 20 years to get me. If he's so smart, why would he tell you all of this?" Westlake asks. "Simple. Like a lot of inmates, Quinn thought I could file some brilliant motion, find a loophole, and get him out of prison. He said he would pay me. Said I would get half of whatever he took off Judge Fawcett. I've heard this before and since. I looked at Quinn's file and told him there was nothing I could do. They have to believe I'm telling the truth. If Quinn Rucker is not indicted, then I'll spend the next 5 years in prison. We're still on opposite sides, me and them, but we're slowly reaching common ground." Chapter 13. 6 hours later, two black FBI agents paid the cover charge at the Velvet Club, 3 blocks away from the Norfolk Naval Base. They were dressed like construction workers and mixed easily with the crowd, which was half white, half black, half sailors, and half civilians. The dancers were also half and half, affirmative action all around. Two surveillance vans waited in the parking lot, along with a dozen more agents. Quinn Rucker had been spotted, photographed, and identified entering the club at 5:30. He worked as a bartender, and when he left his post at 8:45 to go to the restroom, he was followed. Inside the restroom, the two agents confronted him. After a brief discussion, they agreed to leave through a rear door. Quinn understood the situation and made no sudden moves, nor did he seem surprised. As with many escapees, the end of the run was in many ways a relief. The dreams of freedom crumble under the challenges of living normally. Someone is always back there. He was handcuffed and taken to the FBI office in Norfolk. In an interrogation room, the two black agents served him coffee and began a friendly chat. The crime was nothing more than an escape, and he had no defense. He was dead guilty and headed back to prison. They asked Quinn if he was willing to answer a few basic questions about his escape some 3 months earlier. He said sure, why not? He volunteered that he had met an unnamed accomplice not far from the camp at Frostburg and had been driven back to D.C. He hung around there for a few days, but his presence was not well received. Escapees draw attention, and his boys did not appreciate the possibility of the FBI poking around and looking for him. He began muling cocaine from Miami to Atlanta, but the work was slow. He was damaged goods, and his syndicate, as he called it, was wary of him. He saw his wife and kids occasionally, but knew the danger of getting too close to home. He spent time with an old girlfriend in Baltimore, but she too was less than excited about his presence. He drifted around, picking up an occasional drug run, then got lucky when his cousin gave him a job tending bar at the Velvet Club. Next door, in a larger interrogation room, two of the FBI's veteran interrogators were listening to the conversation. Another team was upstairs, waiting and listening. If things went well, it would be a long night for Quinn. Things had to go well for the FBI. With no physical evidence so far, it was imperative that the interrogation produce some proof. The FBI was worried, though, because they were dealing with a man who'd been around the block a few times. It was unlikely their suspect could be intimidated into saying much. As soon as Quinn was taken out the back door of the Velvet Club, FBI agents cornered his cousin and demanded information. The cousin knew the ropes and had little to say until he was threatened with charges for harboring a fugitive. He had an impressive criminal record, state charges, and another indictment would likely send him back to the pen. He preferred life on the outside and began singing. Quinn was living and working under the assumed name of Jackie Todd, though his wages were being paid in cash and off the books. The cousin led the FBI agents to a rundown trailer park a half mile away and showed them the furnished mobile home Quinn was leasing month to month. Parked next to the trailer was a Hummer H3, 2008 model, with North Carolina license plates. The cousin explained that Quinn preferred to walk to work and hide the Hummer, weather permitting. Within an hour, the FBI had a search warrant for the trailer and the Hummer, which was towed to a police lot in Norfolk, opened, and examined. The main door of the mobile home was locked, but flimsy. One good jolt with a bat hammer, and the agents were inside. The place was remarkably neat and clean. Working with a purpose, six agents combed the place from side to side, 12 feet, and from end to end, 50 feet. In the only bedroom between the mattress and the box spring, they found Quinn's wallet, keys, and cell phone. The wallet contained about $500 in cash, a fake North Carolina driver's license, and two prepaid Visa credit cards valued at $1,200 each. The cell phone was of the disposable prepaid variety, perfect for a man on the run. Under the bed, the agents found a Smith & Wesson short-barrel 38 caliber handgun, loaded with hollow-point bullets. Handling it carefully, the agents immediately assumed it was the same handgun used to kill Judge Fawcett and Naomi Clary. The keychain included a key to a mini storage unit 2 miles away. In a drawer in the kitchen, an agent found Quinn's home office, a couple of manila files with scant paperwork. One form, though, was a 6-month lease agreement for a unit at Macon's Mini Storage, signed by Jackie Todd. The lead investigator called Roanoke, where a federal magistrate was on duty, and a search warrant was emailed back to Norfolk. The file also included a North Carolina car title issued to Jackie Todd for the 2008 Hummer H3. No liens were noted. Thus, it was safe to assume Mr. Todd had paid in full, on the spot, either in cash or by check. No checkbook or bank statements were found in the drawer. None were expected. A bill of sale for the vehicle revealed that it was purchased on February 9, 2011, from a used car lot in Roanoke. February 9th was 2 days after the bodies were found. Fresh search warrant in hand, two agents entered Jackie Todd's tiny unit at Macon's Mini Storage, under the careful and suspecting gaze of Mr. Macon himself. Concrete floor, unpainted cinder block walls, a solitary light bulb stuck in the ceiling. There were 5 cardboard boxes stacked against one wall. A quick look revealed some old clothes, a pair of muddy combat boots, a 9mm Glock pistol with the registration number filed off, and finally, a metal box stuffed neatly with cash. The agents took all 5 cardboard boxes, thanked Mr. Macon for his hospitality, and hurried away. Simultaneously, the name Jackie R. Todd was being run through the National Crime Information Center computer system. There was a hit in Roanoke, Virginia. At midnight, Quinn was moved next door and introduced to Special Agents Pankovitz and DeLock. They began by explaining they were used by the FBI to interrogate escapees. This was nothing more than a routine briefing, a little fact-finding probe that they always enjoyed because who wouldn't love to talk to an escapee and get all the details? It was late, and if Quinn wanted to get some sleep in the county jail, they would be happy to start first thing in the morning. He declined and said he would like to get it over with. Sandwiches and soft drinks were brought in. The mood was lighthearted, and the agents were extremely cordial. Pankovitz was white, and DeLock was black, and Quinn seemed to enjoy their company. He nibbled on a ham and Swiss while they told a story about an inmate who'd spent 21 years on the run. The FBI sent them all the way to Thailand to bring him home. What great fun. They asked about his escape and movements in the days that followed it, questions and answers that had already been covered by his first interrogation. Quinn refused to identify his accomplice and gave them no names of anyone who had helped him along the way. This was fine. They did not press and seemed to have no interest in going after anyone else. After an hour of friendly chit-chat, Pankovitz remembered that they had not read him his Miranda rights. There was no harm in this, they said, because his crime was obvious and he had not implicated himself in anything other than the escape. No big deal, but if he wanted to continue, he would have to waive his rights. This he did by signing a form. By this time, he was being called Quinn, and they were Andy for Pankovitz and Jesse for DeLock. They carefully reconstructed his movements over the past 3 months, and Quinn did a surprisingly thorough job of recalling dates, places, and events. The agents were impressed and commended him on having such a fine memory. They paid particular attention to his earnings, all in cash, of course, but how much for each job? "So, on the second run from Miami to Charleston," Pankovitz said, smiling at his notes, "the one a week after last New Year's, Quinn, you got how much in cash?"
"I believe it was $6,000.
"Right. Right." Both agents scribbled furiously, as if they believed every single word uttered by their subject. Quinn said he'd been living and working in Norfolk since mid-February, about a month. He lived with his cousin and a couple of his girlfriends in a large apartment not far from the Velvet Club. He was being paid in cash, food, drink, sex, and pot. "So, Quinn," DeLock said as he tallied up a pile of numbers, "looks to me as though you've earned about $46,000 since you left Frostburg. All cash, no taxes. Not bad for 3 months' work."
"I guess."
"How much of this have you spent?" Pankovitz asked. Quinn shrugged as if it really didn't matter now.
"I don't know. Most of it. It takes a lot of money to move around."
"When you were running the drugs from Miami and back, how did you rent cars?" DeLock asked.
"I didn't rent them. Someone else did, gave me the keys. My job was to drive carefully, slowly, and not get stopped by the cops."
Fair enough, and both agents happily concurred. "Did you buy a vehicle?" Pankovitz asked without looking up from his note-taking.
"No,"
Quinn said with a smile. "Silly question.
You can't buy a car when you're on the run and have no papers."
"Of course not." At the freezer in Roanoke, Victor Westlake sat before a large screen, frozen at the image of Quinn Rucker. A hidden camera in the interrogation room was sending the video across the Commonwealth to a makeshift room outfitted with an astonishing supply of gadgets and technology. Four other agents sat with Westlake, all staring at the eyes and expressions of Mr. Rucker.
"No way," mumbled one of the other four. "This guy's too smart for this. He knows we'll find the trailer, the wallet, the fake ID, the Hummer."
"Maybe not," mumbled another. "Right now, it's just an escape. He's thinking we have no clue about the murder. This is nothing serious."
"I agree," said another. "I think he's betting, playing the odds. He thinks he can survive a few questions, then get hauled back to jail, and then to prison. He's thinking he'll call his cousin at some point and tell him to grab everything."
"Wait and see," said Westlake. "Let's see how he reacts when the first bomb hits." At 2 a.m., Quinn said,
"Can I use the restroom?"
DeLock stood and escorted him out of the room and down the hall. Another agent loitered about, a show of force. 5 minutes later, Quinn was back in his seat. Pankovitz said,
"It's rather late, Quinn. You want to check in at the jail and get some sleep? We have plenty of time."
"I'd rather be here than in the jail," he said sadly. "How much more time you think I'll get?"
he asked. DeLock replied,
"Don't know, Quinn.
That's up to the U.S. attorney. Bad part is that they won't send you back to a camp. Ever. You're headed for a real prison.
You know, Jesse, I sort of missed the camp. Wasn't so bad after all.
Why'd you leave it?
Stupid. Why? Because I could. Just walk away and nobody seemed to care.
We interview 25 guys a year who walk away from a federal camp. Stupid, I think, is the best word.
Pankovitz shuffled some papers and said, Now, Quinn, I think we've got a handle on the timeline here. Dates, places, movements, cash earnings. All of this will be included in your pre-sentence report. The good part is that you didn't do anything exceptionally bad over the past 3 months. Some drug running, which of course will not help you, but at least you didn't hurt anyone, right?
Right.
And this is the complete story, right? Nothing left out? You're telling us everything.
Yep.
The two agents stiffened somewhat and frowned. Pankovitz said,
What about Roanoke, Quinn? Did you spend any time in Roanoke?
Quinn looked at the ceiling, gave it a thought, and said,
Maybe I passed through once or twice, but that's all.
Are you sure about that?
Yes, I'm sure.
DeLock opened a file, scanned a sheet of paper, and asked,
Who was Jackie Todd?
Quinn's eyes closed as his mouth fell open slightly. A soft guttural sound, one from deep inside, came out, as if he'd been struck somewhere below the belt. His shoulders dropped. If he'd been white, he would have turned pale.
Don't know, he finally said. Never met him.
DeLock continued.
Really? Well, it looks like Mr. Jackie R. Todd was arrested on Tuesday night, February 8th, at a bar in Roanoke. Public drunk, assault. The police report says he got in a fight with some other drunks and spent the night in jail. Next morning, he posted a cash bond of $800 and walked out.
Wasn't me.
Is that so?
DeLock slid across a sheet of paper, and Quinn slowly picked it up. It was a mugshot, clearly one of himself.
Not much doubt about it, Quinn, right?
Quinn laid down the sheet of paper and said,
Okay, okay. So I had an alias. What was I supposed to do? Play hide and seek with my real name?
Of course not, Quinn, Pankovitz said. But you lied to us, didn't you?
You're not the first cops I've lied to.
Lying to the FBI can get you 5 years.
Okay, I fibbed a little.
No surprise there. But now we can't believe anything.
I guess we'll have to start over. DeLock said,
On February 9th, one Jackie Todd walked into a used car lot in Roanoke and paid $24,000 cash for a 2008 Hummer H3. This ring a bell, Quinn?
No. Wasn't me.
Didn't think so.
DeLock slid across a copy of the bill of sale. And you've never seen this before, have you? Quinn looked at it and said,
No.
Pankovitz snapped.
Come on, Quinn. We're not half as stupid as you think we are. You were in Roanoke on February 8th, went to the bar, got in a fight, went to jail, bonded out the next morning, went back to your motel room at the Safe Lodge,
back to the room you paid cash for, got some more cash, and bought yourself a Hummer.
Where's the crime in paying cash for a vehicle?
None whatsoever, Pankovic said. But you weren't supposed to have that much cash at that point.
Maybe I was wrong with some of the dates and some of the cash payments. I can't remember everything.
Do you remember where you bought the guns?
DeLock asked. What guns?
The Smith & Wesson 38 we found in your trailer, and the Glock 9mm we found in your storage unit about 2 hours ago.
Stolen guns, Pankovic added helpfully. More federal offenses.
Quinn slowly locked his hands behind his head and stared at his knees. A minute passed, then another. Without blinking and without moving a muscle, the two agents stared at Quinn. The room was silent, still, tense. Finally, Pankovic shuffled some papers and raised one. He said,
"The preliminary inventory shows a wallet with $512 cash, a fake driver's license from North Carolina, two prepaid Visa cards, a prepaid cell phone, the aforementioned Smith & Wesson 38, a bill of sale and a title for the Hummer, a lease agreement for the mini storage unit, an insurance certificate for the vehicle, a box of bullets for the 38, and a few other items, all taken from the mobile home you were renting for $400 a month. From the mini storage unit, we have inventoried some clothing, the Glock 9mm, a pair of combat boots, some other items, and most important, a metal box with $41,000 in it, cash, all in $100 bills.
Quinn slowly folded his arms across his chest and stared at DeLock, who said, "We have all night, Quinn. How about an explanation?"
"I guess the mule was busier than I remember. There were a lot of trips to Miami and back."
"Why didn't you tell us about all the trips?"
"Like I said, I can't remember everything. When you're on the run like that, you tend to forget things."
"Do you remember using either of the guns for anything, Quinn?" DeLock asked.
"No."
"Did you use the guns, or do you just not remember using the guns?"
"I did not use the guns."
Pankovic found another sheet of paper and studied it gravely. "You sure about that, Quinn? This is a preliminary ballistics report." Quinn slowly pushed his chair back and got to his feet. He stretched and walked a few steps to a corner.
"Maybe I need a lawyer."
Chapter 14. There was no ballistics report. The Smith & Wesson 38 was at the FBI crime laboratory at Quantico and would be analyzed as soon as the technicians arrived for work in about 5 hours. The sheet of paper Pankovic held, like a weapon, was a copy of some useless memo. He and DeLock had an entire repertoire of dirty tricks, all approved by the U.S. Supreme Court. Using them would depend on how far Quinn allowed things to go. The immediate problem was the lawyer comment. If Quinn had said clearly and unequivocally, "I want a lawyer," or "I'm not answering any more questions until I have a lawyer," or something along those lines, the interrogation would have ended immediately. But he hedged and used the word "maybe." Timing was crucial here. To divert attention away from the issue of a lawyer, the agents quickly changed the scenery. DeLock stood and said, "I need to take a leak." Pankovic said, "And I need more coffee."
How about you, Quinn?
No.
Delock slammed the door as he left. Pankovic stood and stretched his back. It was almost 3 a.m. Quinn had two brothers and two sisters, ages 27 to 42, all at one point or another involved in the family's drug trafficking syndicate. One sister had eased out of the actual smuggling and selling, but was still involved in various laundering operations. The other had left the business, moved away, and tried to avoid the family altogether. The youngest of the siblings was D. Ray Rucker, a quiet young man who studied finance at Georgetown and knew how to move money around. He had one gun charge, but nothing significant. D. Ray really didn't have the stomach for the fear and violence of the street life and tried to stay away from it. He lived with his girlfriend in a modest condo near Union Station, and it was there that the FBI found him shortly after midnight. In bed, unburdened by outstanding warrants or ongoing criminal investigations, oblivious to what was happening to his dear brother Quinn, carefree and sleeping soundly. He was taken into custody without resistance, but with an enormous amount of bitching. The squad of agents who snatched him offered little explanation. At the FBI building on Pennsylvania Avenue, he was hustled into a room where he was placed in a chair and surrounded by agents, all wearing navy parkas with FBI in bright yellow. The scene was photographed from several angles. After an hour of sitting handcuffed and being told nothing, he was removed from the room, walked back to the van, and driven home. He was deposited at the curb without another word. His girlfriend fetched him some pills, and he eventually settled down. He would call his lawyer in the morning and raise hell, but the entire episode would soon be forgotten. In the drug trade, you don't expect happy endings. When Delock returned from the restroom, he held the door open for a moment. A slender, attractive secretary of some variety entered with a tray of drinks and cookies, which she set on the edge of the table. She smiled at Quinn, who was still standing in the corner, too confused to acknowledge her. After she left, Pankovic popped a can of Red Bull and poured it over ice. "You need a Red Bull, Quinn?"
"No."
He served them all night at the bar, Red Bull and vodka, but had never cared for the taste. The break in the action gave him a moment to catch his breath and try to organize his thoughts. Should he continue, or should he remain silent and insist on a lawyer? His instincts were for the latter, but he was extremely curious about how much the FBI knew. He was reeling from what they had already discovered. But how far could they go? Delock fixed himself a Red Bull, too, over ice, and munched on a cookie. "Have a seat, Quinn," he said, waving him back to the table. Quinn took a few steps and sat down. Pankovic was already taking notes. "Your older brother, I believe they call him Tall Man. Is he still in the D.C. area?"
"What's he got to do with anything?"
"Just filling in some gaps here, Quinn. That's all. I like to have all the facts, or as many as possible. Have you seen much of Tall Man in the past 3 months?"
"No comment."
"Okay. Your younger brother, D-Ray. Is he still in the D.C. area?"
"I don't know where D-Ray is."
"Have you seen much of D-Ray in the past 3 months?"
"No comment."
"Did D-Ray go to Roanoke with you when you got arrested?"
"No comment."
"Was anyone with you when you got arrested in Roanoke?"
"I was alone."
Delock exhaled in frustration. Pankovic sighed, as if this were just another lie,
and they knew it.
I swear I was alone, Quinn said.
What were you doing in Roanoke? DeLock asked.
Business.
Trafficking?
That's our business. Roanoke is part of our territory. We had a situation there, and I had to take care of it.
What kind of situation?
No comment.
Pankovitz took a long pull of his Red Bull and said,
You know, Quinn, the problem we have right now is that we can't believe a word you're saying. You lie. We know you lie. You even admit you lie. We ask a question, you give us a lie.
We're getting nowhere, Quinn, DeLock chimed in. What were you doing in Roanoke? Quinn reached forward and took an Oreo. He pulled off the top, licked the cream, stared at DeLock, and finally said,
We had a mule down there who we suspected of being an informant. We lost two shipments under strange circumstances, and we figured things out. I went to see the mule.
To kill him?
No. We don't operate that way. I couldn't find him. He apparently got word and took off. I went to a bar, drank too much, got in a fight, had a bad night. The next day, a friend told me about a good deal on a Hummer, so I went to see it.
Who was the friend?
No comment.
You're lying, DeLock said. You're lying, and we know you're lying. You're not even a good liar, Quinn, you know that?
Whatever.
Why did you title the Hummer in North Carolina? Pankovitz asked.
Because I was on the run, remember? I was an escapee, trying not to leave a trail. Get it, fellas? Fake ID, fake address, fake everything.
Who was Jaquiel Staley? DeLock asked. Quinn hesitated for a second, tried to shake it off, and answered nonchalantly.
My nephew.
And where is he now?
Federal pen somewhere. I'm sure you guys know the answer.
Alabama, serving 18 years, Pankovitz said. Jaquiel got busted near Roanoke with a van full of cocaine, right?
I'm sure you have the file.
Did you try to help Jaquiel?
When?
Both agents overreacted with feigned frustration. Both took a sip of Red Bull. DeLock reached for another Oreo. There were a dozen left on the platter, and there was a pot full of coffee. From the looks of things, they planned to be there all night. Pankovitz said,
Come on, Quinn. Stop playing games. We've established that Jaquiel was busted in Roanoke. Lots of coke, lots of years ahead in the pen. And the question is whether or not you tried to help the boy.
Sure. He's part of the family, part of the business, and he got busted in the course of his employment. The family always steps forward.
Did you hire the lawyer?
I did.
How much did you pay the lawyer?
Quinn thought for a moment, then said, I don't really remember. It was a sack full of cash.
You paid the lawyer in cash?
That's what I just said. Nothing wrong with cash last time I checked. We don't use bank accounts and credit cards and things the feds can follow. Just cash.
Who gave you the cash? To hire the lawyer.
No comment.
Did you get the cash from D-Ray?
No comment.
Pankovic slowly reached for a thin file and removed a sheet of paper.
Well, D-Race says he gave you all the cash you would need in Roanoke.
Quinn shook his head and offered a nasty smile that said, Bullshit. Pankovic slid across an 8x10 color enlargement of a photograph of D-Ray surrounded by FBI agents, with his hands cuffed, his mouth open, and his face angry. DeLock explained,
We picked up D-Ray in D.C. about an hour after we brought you in.
He likes to talk, you know. In fact, he talks a lot more than you do.
Quinn stared at the photo and was speechless. The freezer, 4 in the morning. Victor Westlake stood again and walked around the room. Movement was needed to fight off sleep. The other 4 agents were still awake, their systems pumped with over-the-counter amphetamines, Red Bull, and coffee.
Damn. These guys are slow, one of them said.
They're methodical, another replied. They're wearing him down. The fact that he's still talking after 7 hours is incredible.
He doesn't want to go to the county jail.
Can't blame him there.
I think he's still curious. Cat and mouse, how much do we really know?
They're not going to trick him. He's too smart.
They know what they're doing,
Westlake said. He sat down and poured another cup of coffee. In Norfolk, Pankovic poured a cup of coffee and asked,
Who drove you to Roanoke?
Nobody. I drove myself.
What kind of car?
I don't remember.
You're lying, Quinn. Someone drove you to Roanoke the week before February 7th. There were 2 of you. We have witnesses.
Then your witnesses are lying. You're lying. Everybody's lying.
You bought the Hummer on February 9th, paid cash, and there was no trade-in. How did you get to the used car lot that day when you bought the Hummer? Who took you?
I don't remember.
So you don't remember who took you?
I don't remember anything. I was hungover and still about half drunk.
Come on, Quinn, DeLock said. These lies are getting ridiculous. What are you hiding? If you're not hiding something, then you wouldn't be lying so much.
What exactly do you want to know?
Quinn asked, hands in the air.
Where did you get all that cash, Quinn?
I'm a drug dealer. I've been a drug dealer most of my life. I've spent time in prison because I'm a drug dealer. We burn cash. We eat cash. Don't you understand this?
Pankovic was shaking his head.
But, Quinn, according to your story, you were not working much for the family after your escape. They were afraid of you, right? Am I right about this?
He asked, looking at DeLock, who quickly confirmed that, yes, his partner was right about this. DeLock said,
The family shunned you, so you began making runs down south and back. You say you earned about $46,000, which we now know is a lie because you spent $24,000 on the Hummer, and we found $41,000 in your storage unit.
Pankovic said,
You came across some cash, Quinn. What are you hiding?
Nothing.
Then why are you lying?
Everybody's lying. I thought we all agreed on that.
DeLock tapped the table and said,
Let's go back a few years, Quinn. Your nephew, Jaquil Staley, is in jail, here in Roanoke, waiting on a trial. You paid his lawyer some amount in cash for legal services, right?
Right.
Was there more cash? A little extra to help grease the system? Maybe a bribe so the court would go easy on the kid? Anything like that, Quinn? No? Are you sure? Of course I'm sure. Come on, Quinn. I paid the lawyer in cash. I assumed he kept the money for his fee. That's all I know.
Who was the judge?
I don't remember.
Does Judge Fawcett ring a bell?
Quinn shrugged.
Maybe.
Did you ever go to court with Jaquiel?
I was there when he was sentenced to 18 years.
Were you surprised when he got 18 years?
Yes, matter of fact, I was.
He was supposed to get a lot less, wasn't he?
According to his lawyer, yes.
And you were in court so you could get a good look at Judge Fawcett, right?
I was in court for my nephew, that's all.
The tag team paused at the same moment. Delac took a sip of his Red Bull. Pankovic said,
I need to go to the men's room.
You okay, Quinn?
Quinn was pinching his forehead.
Sure,
he replied. Get you something to drink?
How about a Sprite?
You got it.
Pankovic took his time. Quinn sipped his drink. At 4:30, the interrogation was resumed when Delac asked,
So, Quinn, have you kept up with the news during the past 3 months? Read any newspapers? Surely you've been curious about your own escape and whether or not it's made the news.
Quinn said,
Not really.
Did you hear about Judge Fawcett?
Nope. What about him?
Murdered. Shot twice in the back of the head.
No reaction from Quinn. No surprise, no pity, nothing.
You didn't know that, Quinn?
Pankovic asked.
No.
Two hollow point bullets, fired from a .38 caliber handgun, identical to the one we found in your trailer.
Preliminary ballistics report says there's a 90% chance your gun was used to kill the judge. Quinn began smiling and nodding.
Now I get it. This is all about a dead judge. You boys think I killed Judge Fawcett, right?
That's right.
Great. So we have wasted, what, 7 hours with this bullshit? You're wasting my time, your time, D-Ray's time, everybody's time. I ain't killed nobody.
Have you ever been to Ripplemead, Virginia, population 500, deep in the mountains west of Roanoke?
No.
It's the nearest town to a small lake where the judge was murdered. There are no black people in Ripplemead, and when one shows up, he gets noticed. The day before the judge was murdered, a black man matching your description was in town, according to the owner of a gas station.
A positive ID or just a wild guess?
Something in between.
We'll show him a better photo of you tomorrow.
I'm sure you will. And I'll bet his memory improves greatly.
It usually does, Delac said. 4 miles west of Ripplemead, the world comes to an end. The asphalt stops and a series of gravel roads disappear into the mountains. There's an old country store called Peacock's. And Mr. Peacock sees everything. The day before the murder, he says a black man stopped by asking for directions. Mr. Peacock can't remember the last time he saw a black man in his part of the world. He gave a description. Matches you very well.
Quinn shrugged and said,
I'm not that stupid.
Really? Then why did you hang on to the Smith & Wesson? When we get the final ballistics report, you're dead, Quinn.
The gun's stolen, okay? Stolen guns make the rounds. I bought it from a pawn shop in Lynchburg 2 weeks ago. It's probably changed hands a dozen times in the past year.
A good point, and one they could not argue with, at least not until the ballistics tests were completed. When they had the proof, though, no jury would believe Quinn's story about a stolen gun. Pankovic said, "We found a pair of combat boots in your mini-storage unit. A cheap pair of fake army surplus, canvas, camouflage, all that crap. They are fairly new and have not been used that much. Why do you need combat boots, Quinn?"
"I have weak ankles."
"Nice. How often do you wear them?"
"Not often if they're in storage. I tried them. They rubbed a blister. I forgot about them."
"What's the point?" "The point is that they match a boot print we took from the soil not far from the cabin where Judge Fawcett was murdered," Pankovic said, lying but doing so effectively. "A match, Quinn. A match that puts you at the scene."
Quinn dropped his chin and rubbed his eyes. They were bloodshot and tired.
"What time is it?"
4:50. DeLock replied.
"I need some sleep."
"Well, that might be difficult, Quinn. We checked with the county jail, and your cell is quite crowded. 8 men, 4 bunks. You'll be lucky to get a spot on the floor."
"I don't think I like that jail. Could we try another one?"
"Sorry. Wait till you see Death Row, Quinn."
"I ain't going to death row because I didn't kill anybody."
Pankovic said, "Here's where we are, Quinn. 2 witnesses put you in the vicinity at the time of the murder, and the vicinity is not exactly a busy street corner. You were there, and you were noticed and remembered. Ballistics will nail your ass. The boot print is icing on the cake. That's the crime scene. After the crime, it gets even better, or worse, depending on one's perspective. You were in Roanoke the day after the bodies were found, Tuesday, February 8th, by your own admission, and by way of the city's jail records and court docket, and suddenly you had a satchel full of cash. You posted bond, then paid $24,000 for the Hummer. Pissed away plenty more, and when we finally catch you, there's another stash hidden in a mini storage. Motive? There's plenty of motive. You had a deal with Judge Fawcett to rule in favor of Jaquiel Staley. You bribed him, something like $500,000. And after he took the cash, he forgot about the deal. He threw the book at Jaquiel, and you vowed revenge. Eventually, you got it. Unfortunately, his secretary got in the way, too."
DeLock said,
"A death penalty case, Quinn. Open and shut. Federal death penalty."
Quinn's eyes closed as his body shrank. He began breathing rapidly as sweat formed above his eyebrows. A minute passed, then another. The tough guy was gone. His replacement said weakly,
"You got the wrong guy."
Pankovic laughed, and DeLock, sneering, said,
"Is that the best you can do?"
"You got the wrong guy,"
Quinn repeated, but with even less conviction.
"That sounds pretty lame, Quinn," DeLock said. "And it'll sound even weaker in the courtroom."
Quinn stared at his hands as another minute passed. Finally, he said,
"If you boys know so much, what else do you want?"
Pankovic replied,
"There are a few gaps. Did you act alone? How did you open the safe? Why did you kill the secretary? What happened to the rest of the money?"
"Can't help you there," I don't know nothing about it.
You know everything, Quinn. And we're not leaving until you fill in the gaps.
Then I guess we're going to be here for a long time, Quinn said.
He leaned forward, placed his head on the table, and said,
I'm taking a nap.
Both agents stood and picked up their files and notepads. We'll take a break, Quinn. We'll be back in half an hour.
Chapter 15. Though pleased with the progress of the interrogation, Victor Westlake was worried. There were no witnesses, no ballistics report linking Quinn's .38 to the crime scene, no boot print, and no simultaneous interrogation of D-Ray. There was motive if they believed Malcolm Bannister's story about the bribe. The strongest evidence so far was the fact that Quinn Rucker was in Roanoke the day after the bodies were found and that he had too much cash. Westlake and his team were exhausted from the all-nighter, and it was still dark outside. They reloaded with coffee and took long walks around the freezer. They occasionally checked on the screen for images of their suspect. Quinn was lying on the table, but not sleeping. At 6 a.m., Pankovitz and Dalak returned to the interrogation room. Each had a tall glass with a refill of Red Bull and ice. Quinn got off the table and settled himself into his chair for another round. Pankovitz went first.
Just got off the phone with the U.S. attorney, Quinn. We briefed him on our progress here with you. And he says his grand jury will convene tomorrow and hand down the indictment. 2 counts of capital murder.
Congratulations, Quinn replied. I guess I'd better find me a lawyer.
Sure, but it might take more than one. I'm not sure how much you understand about federal racketeering laws, Quinn, but they can be brutal. The U.S. attorney will take the position that the murders of Judge Fawcett and his secretary were the actions of a gang, a well-known and well-organized gang, with you, of course, as the trigger man. The indictment will include a lot of charges, including capital murder, but also bribery. And most important, it will name not only you, but other nefarious characters such as Tall Man, D-Ray, one of your sisters, your cousin Antoine Beck, and a couple dozen other relatives.
Dalak added,
you guys can have your own wing on death row. The Rucker Beck gang. All lined up, cell to cell, just waiting for the needle.
Dalak was smiling. And Pankovitz was amused. A couple of comedians. Quinn began scratching the side of his head and talking to the floor.
You know, I wonder what my lawyer would say about this. Got me locked in this dark room. No windows. All night long. Started at what? About 9 last night? And here it is. 6 in the morning. 9 straight hours of non-stop bullshit from you two. Accusing me of bribing a judge.